Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the hosts and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have a problem with these thoughts, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet, this is episode 79 of Registry Matters. Happy Saturday, Larry. The sun is almost high in the sky. It's the middle of the day, practically, and it's 7:30 at night on a Saturday. Well, it's 5 o'clock your time, whatever.
We actually still have sunlight, and I'm having a great time. This is our last episode before we go to the NARSL National Conference. It starts next
that is correct.
Friday, which is actually Thursday for those who come early for some socializing and networking, but it officially kicks off Friday.
And it's Wednesday for those of us that have to trek across the entire United States to get there.
Well, I think that's pretty much everybody, isn't it?
Except for those that live in Texas. Even though, well, if you live on the other side of Texas, it may as well be the other side of the world because Texas is a gigantic state. Have you ever driven I-10 across Texas before? And going west, I'm pretty sure when you cross from Louisiana to Texas.
I have not. I have driven 20, but not 10.
Okay. I-10, if I'm not mistaken, it says it's like 900 miles to the other side. And it's just a really, like, your ego is just deflated. Like, that's a 3-day drive.
Well, it's certainly a 2-day drive if it's 900 miles for an average person.
So. God, 500 miles is something of 8 hours. Anyway, yeah, that is a very debilitating kind of something that will make you go, oh, God, life sucks. It's going to take me forever to get across Texas. And it's all flat and it's hot and it's... Anyway, that's my interpretation of Texas.
Just don't understand what a great state Texas is.
This is correct. They also, if I'm not mistaken, the power grid, there's 3 power grids in the United States. There's like a West Coast version, and there's an East Coast, and then there's Texas. They have their own roughly power grid.
Didn't even know that.
I'm pretty sure I might have, you know, I'm sure it kind of flows, you know, maybe the border is a little bit vague, fuzzy in some places, but I'm pretty sure that that's correct.
So if the network of interties collapse, Texas won't be impacted because they're not connected.
I'm pretty sure that they have their own grid. I'd have to like research, but you know, and that kind of stands because Texas is the only state that has in their constitution that they can secede from the union if they so choose.
I think they can form 5 states if they want to. I've heard something along that line.
Okay, so not to go down too far a tangent, California was voting to split into 3, and I think there was something that, like, they're not allowed to do that, but Texas has it slated in their constitution that they could if they wanted to?
Possibly. We'll have to get one of these experts to tell us, but I've heard rumors to that effect.
Interesting. That's fascinating. Well, we have a jam-packed show tonight. We have some listener questions. We have a question from a Patreon supporter. And we have some late breaking news, which we'll get to here in a second. And then we have a bunch of news articles. And then I didn't mark it, but we have a conversation about this. I'm never going to be able to pronounce this person's last name, but it's a court decision with the United States against. Can you say the word for me, please?
Rosenshein.
Okay. Rosenshein. There we go. Rosenshein. Yeah, I guess it is Rosenshein. All right. So and that's the show that we've got going on for tonight.
That means you don't want to miss a single moment of this episode.
Not 1 second of it. You should strap yourself to your nearest radio, turn those dials, and listen to the static, and tune in for an excellent show.
I can't think of anything else that you could listen to that would be as informative as Registry Matters.
Earlier this week, there was a notice that went out talking about a challenge that's going to be set up in Georgia and trying to get a level of support from the locals in Georgia. And I received a message from a person who said that he cannot go to a public library because the meeting is set up to be at a public library. And that, I think we could start off with a conversation about, is that a challenge for people to visit? That would actually be the whole thing. The meeting is going to be held at a public library. Does that create a point of contention for people?
It does. We have fear and we have reality. I remember when I was a young boy, when the growing up in suburban Atlanta, the crime problem. Mayor Jackson said, "Well, we have a fear of crime, and the crime had really been contained at that time from the high points. It had been trending down, but he said crime is not there, but the fear. There's a lot of registrants who have a fear." That's probably an overblown fear. And at last time I looked at Georgia statute, there's nothing in the registration statute whatsoever that keeps a person from visiting a library. I can't say that supervising officials, when it comes to a person under either state or federal community supervision, may be told that they can't go to a library, and then the challenge becomes somewhat more difficult for them to assert. But what I can say is that if someone can show me, who's not under any type of supervision, just registering, that they are being forbidden to go to a library, that we have the 10th Circuit affirmation of a case from my hometown here in Albuquerque, where Albuquerque tried to go down that rat hole of prohibiting offenders on the registry from using the library, and it cost the city quite a bit of money. I think that the legal fees that they paid out on the losing side to the winner was somewhere in the neighborhood of $1 million. So if there's someone telling of an offender who's merely on the registry, I would like to see that instruction. I'd like to see what authority they're citing to, and I would take that to the NARSL board and propose that we do some litigation, because I think that's a winner for us.
I'm going to have two follow-ups here. So first, can I say the county? Is it okay if I say the county that this guy's from, do you think?
Sure.
Okay, so he says, Coweta is a little tough, I think. They won't even re-register me to vote. I said, are you still on supervision? And he said, no, probation ended last September. So I'm like, who in the world is going to stop you from going to, like, what authority, what agency would say, no, don't go to a library? That's what, like, right out of, like, I almost exploded. I was like, you don't have any restrictions that way. You may have working and living restrictions of where you can be, but nothing says that you can't go to a library.
Well, if he's off supervision, I don't know of the authority. That's why I'm asking to see it. It's one of those challenges I put out there that no one ever comes through. I have the challenge. I'd like to see a petition to revoke supervision that says the sole basis for the petition is a person showed deception on a polygraph. Now, that offer's been out there for a long time. No one has shown that to me yet.
Yeah.
Now, what they have shown me is that a person has shown deception on a polygraph and has ultimately admitted that they've broken their conditions as a part of the post-polygraph interview. They've shown me that. But no one has shown me when it says the petition. All it says was show deception. Well, on this, I would like to see the authority that I know that sheriffs do invent things. That's why I want registration to someday be removed from law enforcement, because it's a civil regulatory scheme. But I know sheriffs invent things and they tell people to do things. So I'm not saying that the gentleman was not instructed to do that verbally, but I'd sure like to see if it was in writing. I'd like to see what they cite to as an authority that says he can't be in a library. And if I can see that, then we can evaluate what to do about it on a legal recourse, what we have, because he has the right to be in a library. And I'd like to, for Henry County, is where the meeting is going to be, and Coweta County is not far away, and the county seat, for those who don't know Georgia, is Newnan. And I think the county is running about 100,000 population now. It used to be very rural, but it's still a relatively small place. And if they've got money to burn, I'd sure like to help them burn some of it.
And then to peel the layer back just a little bit, what about someone that is on supervision? Is there, as far as you know, a blanket restriction saying you can't be in a library?
I haven't looked at the standing conditions of Georgia parole or probation to see if that's a standard condition. It would be problematic because, like I say, the 10th Circuit is not binding. Georgia's at the 11th. But there's a very fine analysis right out there that would be very compelling to the 11th Circuit, that just a total ban. Now, a tailored ban for someone who has an offense
right
pattern
right
that merits that could be done.
Yeah.
But just a blanket ban that if you're on supervision, you can never visit a library, I would find that very problematic, and I'd be interested in seeing that if that's a standard condition of supervision for Georgia. But this gentleman says he's off supervision since September, and I don't know of any authority that would preclude him from going to a library.
And I'm also pretty sure that once you're off of supervision, you can go get yourself re-registered to vote. I don't think there's any delay there after you're done with your supervision before you can get yourself back in the position to vote.
Well, there again, There's a guide of felon re-enfranchisement available. In fact, I think I've referred to it before, but there's a process usually, and it varies from state to state. Sometimes you have to take a,
sure,
you have to take a certificate of discharge from supervision of some sort to the county registrar, the county clerk, which is generally the registrar's voters, but you have to show some proof that you've finaled out your number. But as far as I recall, Georgia's on the list where you can register to vote once you've done your time. So I can't imagine that anybody in the Coweta County administration would want to disenfranchise a voter. Can you?
No, absolutely not. No. I mean, we don't have like a massive shady kind of mess going on in Georgia from the governor's race from a few months back, do we?
Of course not. We're about to have the same thing here. Our Secretary of State has announced as a sitting Secretary of State that she's running for the United States Senate, which is a federal election. She will be the overseer of her own election when she runs in the primary. If she should win the primary, then she would be the overseer of her own election in the general election because she wouldn't step down until she wins the Senate. So it's a great system we have, isn't it?
It's awesome.
I was critical of the Georgia Secretary of State. So to be intellectually honest, I'm also critical of the New Mexico Secretary of State. I'm not sure that she doesn't have a conflict, and I'd like for those who are smarter than I am to take a look at that and see if she can monitor and be in charge of her own election.
And then something else I wanted to ask you about. This one just made my hackles go up. There was obviously a situation towards the last year of Obama's presidency where Scalia unexpectedly died. And obviously there was a vacancy in the Supreme Court, and Mitch McConnell, the Republican senator from Kentucky, he refused to have hearings for a very moderate, incredibly liked guy named Merrick Garland. And then I heard, it freaking got me all upset, that if there is a vacancy in the last year of Trump's term, that he said, well, sure, we'll certainly go fire this up. We'll certainly bring a new nominee and have confirmation hearings. And trying to look for any sort of evidence to support what I thought that I heard, I found that his press secretary, what was the name of it? His staff director. And he said, if there is a vacancy next year, because the White House and the Senate are the same party, we would vote to fill the slot. McConnell's staff director wrote in an email to reporters listing previous statements. That is the definition of hypocrisy.
Well, I'm actually going to partially agree with you. I don't think anybody doubts, if they've listened to this podcast for any period of time, that I'm not particularly fond of Senator Mitch McConnell from Kentucky. But he is in the majority, and he has been elected to lead that majority, which means that the majority, as I've said, they control the levers. The Senate is under majority Republican control, and the Republican caucus elected him to lead them. So it tells us a little something about the situation, is that in my personal opinion, what they did was unprecedented in 2016. And I don't think that there's any way to justify it. But if this represents Senator McConnell's view that he would do that, it would be an interesting thing for him to try to square his being willing to do it for this president. But I tell people, we had an unelected president in 1975 who didn't even get elected to be vice president. And under a Democratic Senate, they took up his nomination and they confirmed Justice John Paul Stevens. I think it was almost unanimously. So it's like if they'd have had that doctrine, and I even went a step further, I said they could have held the vice presidency vacant in 73, because there again, the process was both houses were in the Democratic column in 73, and the vice president appointment made by Nixon had to be approved by both houses. And if they had just simply sat on that, that's the vice presidency was open in October, if I recollect right, of 73. If they'd have just sat on that, to which is essentially about the same amount of time they sat on this Supreme Court vacancy, President Nixon resigned August 8th of 1974. They could have assumed the role of acting president. They did not do that. And then when we were having in more recent times, when we were having the financial collapse in 2008, we were again under Democratic control, and President George W. Bush was able to get his stimulus and his troubled asset restructuring program to save the economy through a Democratic-controlled Congress, because they didn't want to stand in the way and be blamed for the collapse that had begun under Bush's watch. So I don't think it's fair to say that both parties do the exact same thing, because I can cite you examples where they didn't do the same thing. I don't have any faith in the integrity of Mitch McConnell. So I'm not surprised. So this is,
he's a bad dude. He is to me like the most powerful evil person intentionally doing things. I think Trump's kind of a bumbling idiot. That's just my opinion. Send me all the emails. That's fine. But McConnell is a calculated cold scumbag.
I'm not pretending to say that Democrats are without fault. I just got through raising an issue about a Democratic elected official in my state, but I don't think it has risen to the exact same level of what's been going on and transpiring under McConnell's stewardship. The Democrats put up a lot of resistance to judicial appointments of President Bush. And particular Miguel Estrada comes to mind, but when Obama was trying to fill his appointments, they just basically pulled the plug and said, we're not approving anybody. And that's when the filibuster rule for everything except U.S. Supreme Court justices was removed, because he couldn't fill any vacancies. The Republicans were filibustering everything.
So let's fire this up. Check this out, Larry. This one was submitted by one of our listeners, and this is late breaking news sometime during the week. And it says the House passes a chemical castration bill. This is out of Alabama, and this sets up. This is pretty bad. That if you want to get out on parole and you've committed a crime against a very young individual, I think it says the ages between 7 and 13, that you are going to be mandated to take medicine for the rest of your life, or it is a class 1, 2, 3 felony or something like that, misdemeanor or something, and it's going to send you back, back inside.
Well, actually, this is according to the legislative website in Alabama. This was delivered to the governor 10:30 a.m. yesterday. So there's even later breaking news. This is all the governor's.
It's updated.
It's passed the Senate now.
The original article said that it wouldn't pass and wouldn't make it. They thought that it wouldn't make it past the Senate, but it passed basically unanimously in the Senate, huh?
That's what it looks like. But let's deal with the House. It passed the House. It passed the House on a very lopsided vote, and Alabama's heavily Republican. It used to be at one time Democratic, but of the House members, 72 Republicans voted for it, and only one Republican voted against it. And then on the House Democrats, apparently there's only 16. 15 voted against it, and only one Republican voted against it. Now, I don't pretend to know it all, but if I'm looking for who's putting bad legislation forward and handed it to the executive, I see a whole lot more opposition there from the Democratic Party than I do from the Republican Party. Now, their 16, their numbers are so weak, when you've got a margin of 72-16, you're basically irrelevant. But of those 16, 15 voted no. And on the Republican side, 72 voted yes, and only one voted no in the House.
What do you make of this bill in general? Would this pass some sort of constitutional challenge or any sort? It seems like forcing someone to take some kind of medicine for the rest of their life. Especially, to me, this sounds kind of like some voodoo science, but it seems like this wouldn't pass an ACLU kind of challenge.
Well, let's just hope that there's enough of an ACLU in Alabama, because the southern states typically don't have that type of organization that fights this type of stuff. They're very woefully inadequately funded. But I would hope that it'd be challenged. But I'm looking at the vote total. It passed the Senate 27-0, and it looks like 8 abstentions. If it's mandatory, which my reading of the bill is, it is mandatory, I would think that it would be ripe for a challenge, and I would hope it's challenged. But I don't know who the challenging party will be.
Can you at least try and square me? Is there any other condition of parole or some kind of supervision where you are required to take some kind of medicine to stay straight? I'm using that term just to stay clean, to stay out of trouble.
Yes, that's not uncommon. Your condition of probation or supervision could be that a person who has various mental illnesses could be ordered to stay in treatment and to take medications as directed by a physician. Where this is distinguishable, this is not a medical procedure prescribed by a physician. This is a procedure being mandated by the legislature as a matter of law. There's not a medical need for this, but yes, there's people take medications all the time that they're required to take, or else bad things happen to them if they don't.
But and I'm speaking outside of my realm, but so the DSM, the Diagnostics, whatever, Supervision Manual, whatever it is, that would have something in there that says to deal with this level of mental disorder, you're going to take XYZ medicine, and that makes you, you know, within the confines of normal, and this isn't necessarily something that's in there. This is just some legislator saying, this is what you're going to do, take it or leave
it. It. And that doesn't appear to have an option that you can stay in prison. I mean, you can infer from the fact if you don't agree to do it, because it says you have to take it starting 30 days before. We can infer if you don't start taking it 30 days before, they would not release you. But it seems like it's a mandatory thing, and so I'm very troubled by it. And I'm hoping that the people that are in Alabama that will be impacted by this will find some way to challenge it. It's one of those many things that goes on that there's just not enough resources to challenge all the things that lawmakers can think up to do. And I tell people when they want to know when NARSL is going to close down, I say never, because they will never run out of things, and this is an example of it.
I have to ask you this question though. You've been beating me on the phone over this about something being evidence based. There's no evidence behind that this is something that necessarily works. Shouldn't policies be based on evidence?
Can you cite to me in the Constitution where it says that laws have to be based on evidence?
I totally get your question, and I agree with you, but shouldn't they be? Not necessarily are they required to be, but shouldn't we as the population say, well, you're talking some voodoo junk science, and this isn't, and not even necessarily science, but what is evidence-based that something that works versus just making somebody feel good?
Well, I mean, if we were in a perfect world, yes, we would look at evidence-based bases, but that's not the system we have. Everybody gripes about our system, but it's the system we have. There's nothing requiring a group of elected officials to have to do anything that's based on science or evidence.
Oh, God, that frustrates me so badly. That drives me absolutely insane. It really does.
You would have a disagreement about what the evidence and science. I mean, look at global warming. There's the people who believe that it's man-caused, and there's people who just as strongly believe that, and I fall slightly in that group. I have no doubt that I can see evidence of the polar ice caps, and you can look back in 1970 and compare today. You can see the diminishment of the land mass that they cover. But I don't know how much of that man contributed. So you can have... Well, you got the evidence that the ice caps are smaller, but do you have the evidence that man caused that?
I'm inclined to agree with you, but I'm also inclined to defer to like the 99% of the scientists that say so. But I understand your point. It just drives me crazy that we can't be more evidence-based.
Well, we could be.
But I understand it's not constitutional. We the people would have to want to
be. We would have to want to be, yes. But we could be.
All right, well, I'm going to shut down the news sounder, and we can keep going.
Thank you for the late-breaking story for whoever that sent that. We're always looking for...
That was Will. That was Will in Tennessee. Yeah,
we're always looking for late-breaking news.
We did get a question from a Patreon person, and this says, "Hi, Larry and Andy. Do you have tips on what should be included in an interstate compact application for it to be successfully approved? Example is living in a stable environment, having a job lined up, support system, etc. Larry, you are familiar with the applicant situation as you consulted on his retaking back in 2016. The Interstate Compact application is for 4 months parole, sending him from Arizona to New Mexico and no further supervision. Thanks, Christy."
All righty then. Well, if they're trying to compact to New Mexico, the odds are not good, because I can only speak for what I know. And I assume other states are very similar. I know that, in fact, New Mexico is not looking to have sex offenders come. They're looking to figure out a way to deny them. And they don't have a person sitting around answering the phone to try to say, well, if you do this and you do this, you do this, your application will be approved. It makes it very difficult, because you put forth an address and then it's denied. And if Arizona is one of those, if it's one of those states that charges an application fee, you can run up a heck of a lot of money in application fees. But in terms of the question, the biggest thing that'll kill you coming to New Mexico is being within 1,000 feet of anything where children congregate. And that is such a mushy requirement, because they don't even define in the policy, and the probation parole department policy, they don't define how they measure the 1,000 feet. And then sometimes they'll invent things because it's or places where children congregate, and they'll say, well, it's a bus stop there. Children congregate at the bus stop. So that violates right. the policy. So you end up in a really bad situation on trying to go to a state, because there's no one to really call and talk to. But having a stable, everything that was listed is correct. Having an address that's within more than 1,000 feet away from anything you can imagine. Well, if you're in Arizona, yeah. you're trying to figure that out. I mean, you can use the Google apps, but you may miss something. That's step one. And then having employment that's available, and a stable support environment. Another thing that trips up a lot of people that seldom talked about is the sponsor's house, because the sponsor is very object vehemently to having their liberties curtailed. And so the probation people will come in and do an inspection, and they'll say, well, you've got a wrong iron gate, but you can't have that locked. You've got a dog that dog will have to be restrained in the backyard at all times. You've got booze. We notice booze. You can't have it. Do you have any weapons in the house? You're not allowed to have that. And they say, huh? Well, this is my house. I can have them. You're absolutely right. You can have those things in your house, but the offender can't live there with you. So they right. have to have unfettered access. So you try to do anything you can to make sure that the person doesn't have a list of felony convictions, and you make sure that the probation and parole is going to have unfettered access, and that the sponsor is going to be willing to play ball with them in terms of their rules, in terms of alcohol, in terms of weapons, in terms of being very nice and compliant. Because they, when they come in an interview, if they catch any kind of attitude, they're going to look really hard at figuring out a way to decline that residence.
And like the way you word that, they're going to look hard at a way, so they're going to almost invent whatever they can to trip up the process.
They're going to scrutinize. If they get attitude, that tells them what they're going to encounter if that offender lives there. So they're going to be very thorough to make sure that they find something if it's obvious that to say that this house doesn't meet, and then that person has to start all over again. And it's very sad, because there's no easy answer for that.
Certainly. Well, thank you for that question. And here is a voicemail question that we received a handful of days ago.
Hi, Andy, Larry, Christian, Minnesota. How's it going today? Question, you heard the judge pass away in Colorado. What does that mean? What could possibly transpire from this? Basically, if Trump has to appoint somebody else, could the appeals court come back? The federal court, could they change? Could they amend, modify what his decision was? That's the first question. Second, when is the Gundy opinion supposed to be coming out? I'm kind of dying for that one to come out. Thanks, guys. Appreciate it. And FYP. Thanks.
That FYP is catching on, Larry.
I'm so happy that Christian's listening. Didn't realize he was one of our listeners, but yes. That's a great question, and there's been a lot of chatter on it, and so the reference he's making is to Senior District Judge Richard Mage, who passed away, I guess, a week ago. And I didn't know it till 2 or 3 days after the passing. But in terms of what effect it will have, we don't know. But let's talk about what a senior judge is first, so that people understand what the situation is. A senior judge doesn't just mean that they're an older person. In order to get that status, you have to reach a certain age. And I don't remember the formula, but you have to reach a certain age. And I think it's like 65 or 62. And then you have to have a certain number of years of service. And when you have that combination, then you're allowed to take senior status. And when the judge takes senior status, it creates a brand new judgeship in that district. And the reason why they did the senior status is because we recognize that older people generally tend to slow down. Not everybody, so you don't need to write any emails and say, I know a guy that's 84 years old and he works at 7 o'clock in the morning, he goes to 7 o'clock at night, and he can work circles around you. I've already heard all of that. But as a general rule, people begin to slow down, and therefore the work of the judiciary would decline. because they're appointed for life and they can stay on for life. So a new judgeship is created. So practically every U.S. district judge takes senior status at their earliest opportunity to bring a new judgeship in that district. So if the district has 15 judges, all of a sudden it has 16. And then the senior judge can take a reduced caseload. Some of them carry practically the same level of cases that they did when they were before they took senior status, and some reduced dramatically. Judge Mage was 88 years old. I have a feeling that he probably had a very, very light caseload. And just not many 88-year-olds can stand the rigor of a full caseload. So I suspect Judge Mage had a very small caseload. But there's a long established process in terms of what happens when a judge either becomes incapacitated or dies. And their cases are reassigned to another district judge. And I can't speak for the District of Colorado. I don't know exactly when that machinery will take place. I'm guessing they would have waited till the funeral. But the court administration, the clerk of the court, will reassign his cases to other district judges, including this one, that it will get a new district judge assigned to it. And being that he was at that age, he probably had a light caseload, so they may not have to distribute more than 12 cases, but they'll redistribute his cases to another district judge. But the bigger question is not so much that, because if it doesn't already have a new judge assigned to it, it soon will, and somebody could go on PACER and find out. But the bigger question is, will it affect the three-judge panel that's looking at the appeal? There's two possibilities. It could be that of the three judges, that all three of them just adore Judge Mage, and they're going to try especially hard to affirm him as an honor to his service on the bench. That's one possibility, and it would only take two to really adore him to have the majority of the panel. The other possibility is that you could have two of the three that ultimately despised him. And they could do just the opposite. They could say, well, since he's gone, we don't have to worry about flipping him. And I don't mean that term worry literally. Flipping a judge and reversing them is a very harsh dosage of medicine. And it's not taken lightly by appellate courts. They look for reasons to affirm. So flipping a judge, that's serious medicine. It's painful for the judge to get overturned. They take it very personally. Well, Judge Mage is not around to take it personally anymore. And if there's no allegiance and no admiration by at least two of the three on the panel, they could find it easier to set aside his findings and conclusions of law. So in terms of what's going to happen, anybody that tells you they know, you probably should run as fast as you can away from them, because they truly don't know. What we do know is that there'll be a new judge signed soon if it hasn't already happened. And we know that the three judge panel could be impacted one way or the other in terms of looking away to either affirm or to overturn. I'm hoping that the first possibility, that since I understand his reversal rate was fairly low to begin with, I'm hoping that they'll figure out a way to affirm him on this very large case. And I'm hoping that it goes in our favor that he passed away. But I can't say for sure. I don't know.
Okay. And then there was the other question in there. Was that the decision out of Colorado?
No, he's talking about the Gundy.
Oh, that was
Gundy. That
the Gundy. That's right. That's right.
I have little faith that that's going to do anything that anybody's going to be, because it's more about delegation. The Gundy case is more about the authority of Congress to delegate. And I have a feeling that people are going to be sorely disappointed. But I sure hope I am wrong. But I don't see it as being nearly as broad of an impact that most of my professional colleagues agree with me that I've talked to, but I don't see it being a significant factor in SORNA.
You know what we should start, Larry? We should start a segment that is Larry is right or Larry is wrong.
Well, that would be, see, Rush is 99%, I forget what he claims the correct rate, and I'm gonna say that I'm just maybe 1 or 2 points below Rush. But as far as I'm
as far as
I'm concerned, Rush is wrong a whole bunch of times. You know, he invents a whole lot of facts that are not supported.
Yeah, like 350,000 people die by knives every year, whatever that bullshit number was.
He invents the unemployment rate going through the roof under Carter when it actually came down. You know, they still perpetuate that thing, which is so bogus. 11 million jobs were created under the 4 years of Carter, but they say the unemployment went through the roof. And you tell that lie enough times, it becomes true.
I think we're learning that from the current administration. If you keep repeating it, then people start to believe it. Well, before we turn this into a completely partisan show, we have one more, and I totally missed that this one was in there, but we have another voicemail question, and this is Charles.
Hi, Larry and Andy. I have a question for you guys. I was going through a report by the Smart Office regarding New York State Substantial Implementation of SORNA review, May 2015, and the review said that New York State is not substantially implemented SORNA. And then it had a checklist of all the areas where they have not implemented certain sections to match SORNA, and that they're not compliant in certain areas. What does this mean? As you know, I'm not that knowledgeable about these systems here in the States. I don't originate from here. What does it mean if a registry is not substantially implemented SORNA? Does that mean that the registry is somehow not completely legal? I don't know. Please, someone tell me, what does it mean if a state is not substantially implemented SORNA? And do they have to substantially implement SORNA? So I have no clue. Maybe you guys can figure it out for me. But it was an interesting report anyway. Thank you. Take care. And I appreciate the podcast, FYP.
That is another great question, isn't it?
It is a fantastic question. Thank you, Charles, and look forward to seeing you at the conference. The last question is easy. The last part of the question is easiest to answer about, do they have to? Absolutely not. No state has to have a sex offender registry. It's encouraged, but they're not required to. So do they have to bring their registry up to the recommended standards of the Adam Walsh Act SORNA component? No, they do not. And some states have announced that they have no intention of doing that. So they don't have to have a registry at all. Now, as I've said so many times, and people are getting sick of hearing it, transport companies are going to make money on the first state that doesn't have a registry. There's going to be a lucrative moving business headed that direction. So I don't think any state can afford to unilaterally abolish its registry. But in terms of substantial compliance, we probably ought to dissect that. This could be an entire program. I'll try to condense into a few minutes. But in terms of substantial compliance, the first generation registries that were created after the Jacob Welling Act passed in 1996, 94, I believe it was Jacob Welling sometime. Yeah, 94. When the first generation registries passed, after a decade or so of time elapsed, several gaps were noticed in the registration. And that's what caused the Adam Walsh Act to pass in 2006. It was recognized that states who lost track of registrants under the first generation systems had no incentive to find them. And I tell people, and I get strange looks when I say this, if you're responsible for tracking registrants and 100 of yours are safely out of state, are you going to spend your money trying to bring them back to your state if you're rational? Or are you going to go back and uncork the biggest bottle of champagne and celebrate that they're off your grid and off in somebody else's territory? I mean, which would you do?
So that
was one of the gaps. They realized that there was very little incentive for states to track down noncompliant registrants. Once they disappeared off the grid and all evidence pointed to them being out of state, they vanished. And allegedly, there was 100,000 missing and unaccounted for. And so the feds, recognizing that they didn't have the jurisdiction to create a federal registry because the limitations of the federal, our separation of powers of what the feds and states can do and our federalist doctrine, that the federal government doesn't have the power to have a registry except for possibly those who are in the federal system, being the federal court system or maybe military. Convictions, but they had no power to create a registry. But what they do have the power to do is what they did, what we talked about last week about the National School Lunch Program. They have the power to entice states with funding, and that's what they did with the Adam Walsh Act. They said, well, we help you guys out a lot with money in the Byrne Justice Grant Program, and we will give you the opportunity to bring your registry up, we'll give you 3 years of time from 2006 to 2009 to bring your registry, which meant that states had to add offenses, that states had to register adjudicated juveniles over 14, and they had to agree to transmit information more quickly and to interface with other states and jurisdictions, and they had to agree to shorten the initial compliance period down to 3 days. Initial registration, and they had to do a lot of things to meet. That's the checklist he's referring to of things that you need to do to bring your registry into substantial compliance. Substantial compliance is not absolute compliance. That's why they use the word substantial. It's meeting enough of the requirements on the checklist that anything where you're deficient doesn't substantially disserve the purposes of SORNA. And states have been allowed some variations in terms of the 3 days. The more geographically large states have been allowed to be deemed substantially compliant with a slightly longer period of time. The employment listing on the internet, some states have been allowed some variation in terms of how they make that information available in the registry. So there's some latitude, and that's an executive function of the Department of Justice of how much they want to allow latitude to grant that substantial compliance. If New York has chosen not to comply after they saw the checklist of where they're deficient, the only thing that happens to them is they potentially lose 10% of their burn grants, which varies according to the size of the state. They could lose a lot of money, being that New York's a larger state, or they could lose a relatively small amount of money for the less populated states like Wyoming or New Mexico. If they have not just said we reject this altogether, we're not going to do it. If they claim to be working toward substantial compliance, there's a workaround process where they can still get their 10%. But it always amazes me that people who hate the federal government, like I talked about the federal school lunch program, national school lunch program last week, all you have to do is just tell the federal government, we will enforce our own laws. We don't need federal dollars here. We take responsibility for law enforcement very seriously. We're willing to tax ourselves to pay for that. We don't want your Sherman tanks. We don't want your armored personnel carriers. We don't want all this federal intervention, and you can sell your own direction. But very few states are willing to do that. They want to grab as many federal dollars as they can.
I just have to ask this question. Where do the federal dollars come from?
Well, they come obviously from a couple of sources. They come from personal income taxes. They come from corporate income taxes, a lot less now than what they used to in decades past. A significant amount comes from borrowed money that we put on the credit card. And the point you're trying to make, though, is that they come from the people of the states. But some states get a much larger return on their money that they send to the federal government. If you look at the breakdown on what states contribute versus what they get back, some states get back nearly twice in federal revenue and expended in their state than what they actually pay in federal taxation. Some states get back less than 100% of what they pay in. So the theory that conservatives will argue is, well, why should we even send the money there to start with? Because all they do is charge overhead and send it back. Well, in some cases, you're getting money back you never sent. If you're one of those states that's on the receiving end of the dole, which plenty of them are, and mine's one of them, we're way in the top five of receiving end of the federal dole. We couldn't exist without that. But yes.
Well, that is what I was asking. I mean, we talk about wealth redistribution, talking about poor people versus rich people, but this is the same thing at a state level, not necessarily from rich or poor, but there are states that produce and there are states that consume, and it's the same thing. A state, I mean, the total federal tax bill has to be, you know, it's a dollar of X, and then we have the 50 states and plus the other stuff that contributes money, and then it gets distributed around. It's the same thing. It's wealth redistribution regardless.
Well, the wealth redistribution is fine as long as it's being distributed in an upward fashion. We have no problem with that. We just have some kind of abhorrence to any type of distribution as it's coming back down to the lower end of the people. But I could go on and on about people. People are happy for federal support for the essential air service. Oh, people love that. You know, the rural areas where it doesn't justify. Mm-hmm, oh, they're delighted to that. The rural post offices, the people living in rural areas. Yes. Oh, they're delighted that the post office. I mean, if you were looking at a straight business model, you'd close down those post offices. They don't justify. But absolutely. I mean, there's a whole lot of things. It depends on which way wealth is being redistributed. But people are all for it if it's the right people. So,
yeah, I didn't want to send us down that tangent, but it just like it seems to me that at some point someone's saying, "Hey, I'd like to receive these funds," and oh wait, didn't that money come from potentially another state? It's anyway. Hey, Larry, we have a bunch of articles to cover. You ready?
Yeah, let's get going. We got 10 minutes to do 10 articles.
It's going to take us probably. Well, I guess we could go to a lightning round. This first one comes out of USA Today. Charging 10-year-old as an adult in a death of an infant is not only wrong, but damaging. This kid did something pretty heinous, but I can't imagine that a 10-year-old actually has a clue of the ramifications of the action. So the kid, the 10-year-old, dropped his or her infant brother or sister, and the kid started crying. Imagine that. You smash your head on the floor, and you start crying. How do you make a crying infant stop, Larry?
Well, I don't...
You smash its head into the ground until it stops. Anyway, so yeah, that's heinous and terrible, and no one should ever even consider this. But how do you then try that child, that 10-year-old, as an adult and put him in an adult system?
Don't, and we wouldn't in my state, but apparently other states do, and this is tragic.
This is Wisconsin. Scott Walker. Well, yeah, he's not the governor anymore, but still. Yeah,
this is the USA Today took a pretty tough stance against it. I can't fathom a 10-year-old being now, and don't hear this as a bleeding heart saying they shouldn't be held accountable. Of course, we'll keep the 10-year-old in some sort of custody, and we'll monitor the 10-year-old as they grow up, and we'll very carefully evaluate each year of their maturity, and we'll try to figure out at what point it's safe to release them from custody. But giving up on a 10-year-old for life, to me, is just that's un-American. It's immoral that we would think that's the right solution is to write them off.
I can just picture you're going through that line when you're doing like the intake into prison and everybody is very lacking clothing. And, you know, there's all the different heights and weights. And then there's a 10-year-old in that lineup. I can't even see how that
would
work.
They're not going to put them in an adult prison, but they'll give them an adult penalty in terms of, you know, if it's life without parole. And the Supreme Court said you can't do life without parole for a kid, but they'll give them a very harsh penalty, as harsh as they can give them. And that's so wrong, because the 10-year-old, I don't think I've done anything that crazy as a 10-year-old, but I think we've done some crazy stuff that could have been dangerous that we would like to forget about. I know I've played yeah. around with fireworks and almost blown my hands up, and could have just as easily blown up another of my playmates. I mean, we do some crazy things when we're growing up. It's amazing we survive.
Yes, it is. And then let's move over to this article quickly, thecourthousenews.com. And I got to tell you, Larry, when I first started reading this, I was like, this doesn't sound, A, it doesn't sound like California, and B, I had it backwards. It says, use of force reform bill sails through California Assembly. And I'm thinking that they are going to escalate. I thought they were going to escalate their use of force. But this is actually them. I'm trying to find the terms. It says, the San Diego Democrat wants to raise the bar for using deadly force from reasonable to necessary. Please, please, please tell me you can unpack those terms.
Well, reasonable gives a lot more deference to the officer's judgment. Necessary would allow it to be looked at by what a person would do in similar situation. It's not the best standard. I would like, this is a step in the right direction, but when you get to decide whether something was necessary, you're looking at it at more objectively than if it's just reasonable, because officer can say anything was reasonable in the circumstances. I was there. You weren't. I mean, like the 14-year-old sent you that got body slammed by two officers in the video.
Yes.
So, but it appears to have bipartisan support in the state assembly, which is good. I mean, the Republicans have very small numbers in the California assembly, but to their credit, it looks like everybody voted for this. So it's probably the most token reform you could get that would get bipartisan support to get through to get through in that 66-2 ratio.
And then we have an article out of the Washington Post. I just read these articles, Larry, and I just always end up struggling with the idea that, yeah, we don't want these people to do a thing, but should the thing that we don't want them to do be a death sentence. This article is a saggy pants violation led to a fatal police chase. A Louisiana lawmaker wants to repeal the law. You have city ordinances running around where you can't have your underwear showing and so forth. And so this guy has his pants sagging and a police officer says, stop, pick up your pants. And then a chase ensues. And then he shoots him and the guy dies for having his pants sagging.
Well,
I just don't see how it's a death sentence.
Well, he should have. This is me being devil's advocate, but this is what the people say that are 100% with the cops. He should have complied, and yes, he should have complied, but he didn't. And for whatever reason, he might have had a little bit of dope on him. Maybe he had a misdemeanor warrant out for him. For whatever reason, he didn't comply, or maybe he just had a total mistrust of police because of something that has happened to him or a family member. But he didn't comply.
That's not true. That doesn't go on.
But the outcome was a tragedy, and it was, this is one of those articles I couldn't get to open, but I got the gist of it that he was pursued because of the saggy pants. And if we're wrong about that, we'll clean it up next episode. But people for various reasons don't comply. Sometimes they don't understand the directions. Depending on what kind of substance you're using, you're not thinking clearly. When an officer starts barking out orders to you, you're frightened. I mean, there's a whole bunch of reasons why you don't comply. I didn't comply one time with the police. I eventually did, but I was a juvenile and I was looking in some school classrooms, had no intention of breaking in. I was just walking around behind the building, peering in. By that time, the police went and I took off running because I figured that he wouldn't believe me. I said, if it's just looking, but you know, people for various reasons don't comply.
Right. I here's a quick little story. So as a teenager, I had a nice convertible that was afforded to me that was my dad's car. So I'm 16 or 17. And me and somebody were going very fast. And we came up on a cop car. And this would have been, I don't know, maybe 10 o'clock at night or something like that. And we came up on him fast. And as soon as we caught up to him, he turned on his lights. And I broke and I cut down into a neighborhood and then cut down another side street and I put the top up. And my heart was coming out of my chest, if you can imagine. And nothing ever came from it. But I sat there, I was like, put the top up to try and change the appearance of the car in case the cop got it. Yeah. Anyway, I fled. I could have died.
Well, the point I'm making is we look at things through adult eyes and through our own life experiences of what he should have done. Yes, he should have complied, but he didn't. And that's going to continue to happen for a whole host of reasons.
But let me take another little tangent. With my little young lad, I have a very different idea of how I'm going to teach him about law enforcement. Yes, they are there to dial 911 and to hopefully save you from a dire situation. But I am also telling him, do not open your effing mouth and tell them anything ever. If you have representation, unless you have to, but you should put up a significant wall of distrust from these people because they are not necessarily on your side always.
That's pretty accurate advice that particularly if you're in a custodial situation, meaning that your freedom to leave is in doubt. If you've got an officer questioning you, that's a particular dangerous situation to be in. I mean, it's not a great situation if officer questions you when you think you are free to leave, but if you're clearly not free to leave, you're in a much more precarious situation. If officer's detaining you, chances are they're looking for a way to continue that detention. Anything you say is probably going to cause that detention to continue.
And then this one comes from the New York Times. Colleges challenge a common protection in sexual assault lawsuits. Anonymity. Please, please, please drive this bus because this one kind of flew over my head to a large degree.
Well, I'm going to come down differently on this than people would expect because I am in the defense business. But I'm not completely oblivious to the need for some anonymity to a particular point of the investigation. And this is about colleges that are saying that the complainer, this complainer will identify herself as SB, that she has to, her name and all this information has to be made public. And I guess some colleges are beginning to take a different stance and providing the anonymity, and that's causing some consternation. I deeply believe in the right to be confronted by your accuser. And I would never back away from that. But I do believe that there are situations early in an investigation where until a person is going to be a viable suspect, and they're going to be, if you call your neighbor and you've got a barking dog or something, and the you'd rather not give your name, because that's something that can be independently verified or probably a better example would be a loose dog rather than a barking dog. If the dog is loose and the animal control comes and finds the dog you describe, it really doesn't make a difference who called it in, because the evidence is self-effectuating. You got the dog. If the animal control officer lets the dog lead to his master, and you give the person the citation, and the neighbor that called it in doesn't have to have their tire slashed. So or their throat or something else slashed. So I can get that. There's a point where in the initial phases of an investigation, I can see anonymity. But once you're going to go out and engage a named suspect and potentially subject them to prosecution, that person who you're going to talk to deserves to know who's accusing them of what. How can they defend themselves without knowing that? I mean, if you come to talk to me and say, well, we got this complaint that says that on a frat party where there's 114 people at last Saturday night that you did so-and-so, I'm saying, well, who said I did what? Well, we can't tell you that. I said, well, then come back and see me when you can, because I don't know how to defend myself. I don't know who the hell said what. I touched a girl. Well, I did touch a girl. I made out with a girl voluntarily. Maybe I did, maybe I didn't, but I need more specifics. Tell me what's up. Who said what? So I can see partial anonymity until the accusation gets traction. And when it gets traction, I'm sorry, we're in an adversarial system in America. You have to reveal yourself.
I can't, in my simple legal mind, I can't see a way to do this without having without having the ability to question the person that is accusing you. I don't see how you can do it in a mediated. I mean, that's what a court is a mediated process.
Right, but we're talking about the university's investigation before. So the university gets the complaint. What if they're able to extinguish it without ever having any talk to you? What if SB says all this stuff is true and four of my friends can verify it? Before you go talk to the male, you go talk to four of SB's friends and they say, she's smoking crack. That didn't happen. Then you don't even need to go talk to the guy, because you can say, based on this, we find no evidence to support anything you say. At that point, nobody's in jeopardy. But I believe that once jeopardy comes into play, I think that the person who's in jeopardy needs to know who's accusing them of something. I mean, I may have it all wrong, but that's the way I see it.
Yeah, I do understand your point. It feels so insensitive to the person that has the trauma. And I know we've gone over this. I have a very hard time coming off of that side of it. It, you know, like the whole believe women, the whole Me Too movement. I have a hard time coming all the way off of that in being insensitive to the other side. But at the same time, you have people getting accused of stuff and they shouldn't have their life ruined for something that may turn out to be less than a valid accusation.
Well, at the point,
the consequences are severe.
At the point the person's going to be publicly outed, I think that changes the dynamics. When the person who's the object of the investigation is going to be made publicly outed. But until then, like I say, if you could resolve the complaint without, if you could verify the veracity of the complaint far enough to either dismiss it and say there's no merit here, or we're going to have to go further, I think there's a point in time where the person could possibly be anonymous, but there's a point where they're going to have to step forward. And that's just our system. If you believe we should live in a country where you don't get to know who's accusing you of anything, I welcome you to make that argument. I don't want to live in that kind of country. I agree with Justice Scalia that confrontation is one of the most precious rights we have in the Constitution, and he was a great defender of that.
This next one, I don't even want to say the name of this URL. This website is ky3.com. And this is a super duper short, but God, Larry, this one kind of moves, I guess, over into my wheelhouse of things. But Missouri joins nationwide sex offender registry. The first question is, I didn't think there was a nationwide sex offender registry.
Isn't. That's not what they're talking about, but go ahead.
Oh, what are they talking about?
They're talking about the platform that links the registries together, the offender watch. That it's, I think it's
part, oh, yeah.
I think it's part of the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. I think it's something they operate, if I'm not mistaken.
And that's what it says in the article. The reason for me, the reason why I say that this kind of moves into my wheelhouse is there is a statement that you have to internalize and actually accept and believe to be true. And short of any sort of extreme circumstances, if it is on the internet, it is forever. You will never come off of this website. Google will end up having it cached. You will be here forever. That is why this bothers me so very bad.
What is the solution to the information that Google and other people have collected? What do we do about it as a public policy?
Other nations, and I'm specifically thinking of Germany, they have something in place called the right to be forgotten, and you can petition. But in this case, I mean, it is factual information. Yes, I'm pretty sure that you could get this information squashed if you were in another country and all the other mechanisms were equal, that you would be able to petition to have this stuff removed, because you are then not on the registry anymore. And then you could get them to purge it from their caches. But once this stuff is on the internet never forgets. And so now you get this marker forever. It never goes away. I don't care if you're a first offender. If you show up on somebody's registry website, one of these guys, you're done. It's over.
Well, when you say purge, when it is purged, is it really purged? Is there a way to actually purge information? I thought once it was on too many servers or whatever you call those dingy things that there was no way to actually extinguish what other people were holding. Is there a way to purge it?
There would be from the individual place that you are trying to purge from. So we'll just say Google in this particular case. So you would say, hey, Google, I want this stuff removed. And for practical purposes, I don't know if it's for literal purposes, you will no longer show up in a Google search when you type in your name and type in registry stuff. And again, I'm talking hypothetically, you're in Germany, and let's say as a kid you were part of some Nazi group, and you're like, no, that was a mistake, that was something I did forever ago, I have the right to be forgotten, and so you petition and you can get your junk removed. There. And when someone types in your name and Nazi whatever, then you don't show up in the Google search platform within the confines of Germany. I don't know that it applies to the entire platform. But if all these other websites, these other search engines and historical places, if they've captured your data, you will still show up.
That's what I was getting at. Wouldn't it? Wouldn't you be like chasing your tail? Because wouldn't there be so many?
Yes. Yes. So, you know, and that extends out further to have another little lesson. Any picture you post on Facebook, anything you publish out there on the internet saying, hey, we did this, or we did these keg stands at these parties and all this, your junk is going to be out there and you're going to be tarnished forever. You have lost control over your information. And that's the same thing with this stuff. This is very sinister for this website to be able to do this.
What are you as a citizen going to do about it?
You would then have to have very extreme control over what information, what's your digital footprint, how much you leak. You've got to be ridiculously aware of it and try and squelch as much of it as you can.
Caution people on that when they're proud of everything they put on Facebook.
Yeah.
I say, well, you know, you realize that you're creating a record that I don't think can be removed. And 10 years from now, when it's not as funny, when you're sitting in that interviewer's office, you may regret that you did that.
Yep. Definitely. This article comes from The Atlantic, and it's kind of an interesting little twist on things. The collapsing crime rates of the 90s might have been driven by cell phones. This lays out the case that perhaps instead of having your crew standing on the street corner guarding your turf and selling your drugs and doing all the gang war things, but throw that into having a cell phone where, hey, Larry, you're my dope dealer. I can just call you and we can meet somewhere and we can do some, you know, in private. I didn't have to drive over to your house and cross turf and all this stuff. And this presents a halfway compelling case that at least a portion of the drop in crime rates starting from the 90s has a lot to do with people being able to communicate with people easier.
Well, I threw this in here for that reason, in addition to that, just the charts. It's a long article, as as Atlantic always articles are, but
I was like, the Atlantic always does that.
But there's the charts showing the crime rates, because people look, they go ballistic, particularly in Georgia, when I talk about the collapse in crime rate. And and you can, I mean, they run it back to 1960 on the first chart, and you can see how the crime rate, how we're living in some of the safest times of our life. And so I put it in there for that reason. Then you look at the second chart that goes back to the 1700s, the homicide rate in the United States, which was measured by 100,000 people. And you look at the homicide rate in the 1750 colonial times, between 1750 and 1800, far higher than it is today. And when I say you're safer being alive today, this is the best time to be alive. People look at me like I'm nuts. And this is truly...
Do you think that's an artifact of people hearing about the crime rate? So, like, the peak on the far right of that last graph, the peak is it's halfway between 50 and 2000, so roughly 1975, roughly where that peak would be.
Yes.
Do you think that, like our institutional memory comes from watching the report saying the crime rate this, the crime rate that, and so then that's just what you know you remember, and that's what you think it is today, because... I don't think that they really talk about this changing very much often in the news.
Well, it's that, and then the 24-hour news cycle, and then the alternative platforms where you're being bombarded with stuff. If you think back to the Walter Cronkite days, you didn't hear a whole lot about crime unless you lived in that particular community. Something had to be sensational to make Walter Cronkite or Huntley Brinkley or Frank Reynolds or one of the networks. So you heard, and then on local newscast, you didn't hear the sensationalizing. Now you've got so many sources for news, and people are trying to fill time. News organizations are trying to fill time, and so we get a lot of sensationalization. But if you look about 1980, the crime started coming down, and it's been coming down ever since. And this is the best time to be alive. You couldn't pick a better time to be alive than now. In terms of your,
I completely agree with all the technology that you pick on me about too.
But in terms of that's been a factor in the crime. A kid being abducted today is so much less likely because of the technology. You've got cameras all over the streets of every major moderate sized city, and even smaller cities. They've been put up by your Department of Homeland Security that you've pumped many billions and hundreds of billions of dollars into. Then each individual is a walking technology, because they have their own technology with their camera phones. Then every vehicle is carrying technology. Everybody's got a dash cam nowadays. There's cameras everywhere.
As you should. As you should.
And therefore, you're safer because technology is watching the bad guys. And again, this is the best time to be alive in terms of your personal safety. If you're living in one of these cities that's experiencing explosion of crime, you don't think that, but even my city, where they think we're having an explosion of crime, our crime rate is still lower here than it was at the peak in the 80s and 90s. It has been trending upward in the last 3 or 4 years, but we still have a lower crime rate than we've had in recent years, in my memory.
Let me take a quick, teeny little detour. You have worked on the defense side for quite a many years. If someone came in and said, I'm being accused of XYZ accident, hit and run, and I show up with a dash cam that shows me not doing the thing, is it done? Is it slam dunk? I won't have a problem?
Well, I can't say it's a slam dunk. It'd be very compelling if the prosecutor was going to go forward with a hit and run and you had dash cam showing that, but yeah, you'd have to authenticate the dash cam. We'd have to have the experts see if it was been monkeyed with. I mean, it wouldn't just be as simple as going in, because we don't know the source of that dash cam and where it's been. But it very well could be the end of that case if they had brought one, if everything checked out.
Okay. I feel that people have dash cams so they can like catch the latest meteorite coming into the atmosphere, but I personally have cameras at my house, and I have camera in my car to protect me from a false accusation, which feels kind of like the inverse of why people are doing it.
It would be a great thing if you have a hit accident where you make contact and the driver of the other vehicle says something different, and you've got dash cam ready to play for the investigating officer. The investigating officer will say, well, I just look at the cam. What do you have to say about that? And the person may back off.
Right.
But my point is safety has been enhanced by technology, not just the cell phone, but the cell phone video. Can you imagine approaching a teenager today and saying, get in the car? What would happen to you if you did that? There's going to be at least a still photo, probably a live stream of you possibly downloaded on the internet as you're doing it. Nobody's going to do that.
Yes. Now, I would think that it pretty much it depicts exactly what 1984 was depicting in that book. You probably read that book because it came out.
I did.
A long time ago.
Yeah, it came back out in the 60s or something?
Yeah, I read it while I was gone. God, besides me not being able to stay awake reading it, because it is a very slow, dry book, in my opinion, it is a interesting read. From the New York Post, Larry, there's this guy. He was he a senator or just a representative?
Yes, I can't remember.
At New York, correct?
Yes.
And he was caught trading some naughty pictures with a 15-year-old, right?
That's what he pled to. Yes.
And I'm going to get to the title. I'm working my way back through this backwards. This individual as a representative, state level,
federal level. U.S. Congressman.
Oh, he was a U.S. Oh, he was a U.S. Senator. Okay, sorry. U.S. Representative. He said that he wanted the police to do more because there were registrants living in his district. And, of course, I'm talking about Anthony Weiner. He complained about sex offenders in district before his own scandal. And he was just released from, I think, a halfway house. And there's a picture of him as a civilian. And he is now on the registry like the rest of us.
The level.
I'm just pointing out the hypocrisy of this whole thing.
He's a level one, which means he won't be visible to the public under New York's registry system. But I wouldn't be quite as critical as you've been. Yes, it is hypocrisy, but I don't think we understand that most of these people have no idea. Just like your average citizen doesn't know how bloated the registry is. As a U.S. congressman, he would have had no idea how expansive the registries have become, because they're largely creations of the states. He might have and probably did vote for the AWA in 2006. I doubt he read it. It was like everything else that they passed. Very few people read the stuff in detail. He wouldn't have known until it impacted him. All you people out there that are shaking your head, remember, you didn't know either until it impacted you. And he would cut him a little bit of slack. He didn't know the expansive nature of the registry, and he would not have thought of a sex offender in the terms of the pictures. Most people, when you talk about the sex offender registry, since they refer to them as pedophiles, child molesters, sexual predators, you don't think of the indecent exposure in person that can get you on the registry in so many things, states. You don't think about the consensual sex. As a lawmaker, you're totally oblivious to that. So he would have been receiving complaints from constituents, and he would have been doing what good Congress people do with the staff they're provided, that they would, rather than telling the constituent, it's your problem, he's living in your neighborhood, don't call us, he would have said, oh, the constituent services people would have said, gee, we'll look into that for you. Try calling your Congress office, your congressperson's office, and when they tell you, it's not our problem, call somebody else. Tell me how warm and fuzzy you feel about that congressman after you do that, or Congress lady, in whichever the case. Tell me how you feel. So he did exactly what any congressperson would have done when a constituents call their offices. They try to be responsive, and they would have looked into it and said, oh, well, yes, we'll call the state police or whoever the enforcement authorities are and find out if that person's in compliance. That's exactly what you would do.
Okay, I'll back off. Don't these people, shouldn't they have some certain higher level of awareness than the rest of us, which is why they're representing us?
Well, theoretically, yes, but the number of issues they face are enormous, and sex offenders typically hide under rocks. They do not show up at meetings. They do not engage with their Congress people. They do not engage with their U.S. senators. They do not engage with their state senators. It would be a lot better if the sex offenders would show up at public meetings and say, Mr. Congressman, Ms. Congressman, did you know that all I did was this, and name what you think is your story about how insignificant it was, and I'm required to do all this. Are you aware of that? And oftentimes they'll tell you, right, No, I'm not aware of that. I thought the sex offender registry was full of predators. That's what I thought. just go to Hangout. If you can find anybody in the Macon Mall, which I think is the closest major mall to you, find it. Ask people about the Sex Offender Registry and ask them. Just start going randomly into to people and say, who's on the Sex Offender Registry? What type of person? And tell me what you get as an answer.
Certainly. Yeah, I know. I totally know that's what you're talking about. I know. I the hypocrisy is like, hey, now you're on the other side of the coin, so this is what you get to deal with.
Now. And magically now he will feel differently about the Sex Offender Registry. If you were to talk to him now, he would tell you that he was wrong. The only problem is he doesn't have as much power to do anything about it. You need to recognize you're wrong while you have power. It's too late now because his credibility is pretty well shot. He's not going to be all that persuasive in advocating for change in public policy now that he's on the registry. That's not the way it should be, but that's the way it is.
Larry, in my favorite article of this week is an article from CNN. It says, jailers shut off water to Terrell Thomas's cell and he died of dehydration. His family now has $6.75 million. How many days did they shut off the water for? They shut it off for 7 days. So this batch of slimy crotch goblins left this guy in his cell. And there's a quote in there that says, well, I only meant for them to turn off the toilet water. No, they turned off the whole cell for 7 days and he died of dehydration. I can't figure out how we do this. I can't, like, what crime could somebody commit that we just let somebody die of dehydration?
Well, it's hard for me to imagine how that in the course of 7 days that if you're pleading with them saying there's no water in my cell, usually there's a compassionate person somewhere in a jail that says, I'll go take this up with my supervisors in case something shouldn't have happened here. That just totally befuddles me. I like to try to be open-minded and give some benefit of the doubt, but it's almost as if that was an administrative decision to deliberately be indifferent. And that's probably why the $6 million settlement or award. Was it a jury award or a settlement? I couldn't tell.
Yeah, I didn't catch that either. I am intrigued. So to me, it feels like, one person did it, probably at the direction of his supervisor, you know, whatever that's, lieutenant, shift, whatever the hell you want to call him. Then shift would have changed. Somebody else would have been aware of it. I got to think. You would have, in 7 days, they would have gone through at least 2 shift cycles and day and night. So 4 total shift cycles of people aware of this and no one called into question.
Well, I thought we had three shifts in a day. I think you'd have 3 shift changes a day for 7 days.
Well, there could be, if it's 8 or 12. So some of the places I've been, they were 12 and like 2 and 5 or 5 and 2 kind. So that's like the minimum. I'm just saying that's the minimum number of people that would have been passing this guy's cell and catching that this is going on.
I agree. But in the course of that amount of time, it seems like that someone would, the guy's sticking his head out the window and he's saying through his little porthole and he's banging, saying, I'm about to drop dead. I got no water in here. Well, assuming that there's some bad people working in the correctional facility, there's also usually some good people. And it seems like that somebody in the course of over a few days span would say, you ain't got no water in there. What did you just say? And they would have gone to the duty desk and said, Captain, this person doesn't have any water. What are we going to do about that? And the captain would have said, huh? Unless the captain ordered, the captain would say, of course we're going to do something about that. And then the person would say, well, if you're not going to do something about it, I am. I'm not going to let a person die on my watch, sir. It's not going to happen. Now, everybody pretends like we're different from the Germans and we just simply follow orders. That would be an order I would disobey. If the captain said, I order you, I said, no, sir, I'm not going to let a person die on my watch. Not going to happen. So we got to get water to this man.
Or you call in somebody. I'm like, hey, I need to call my state representative. I have to call the governor. I have to call somebody.
Well, I'm just going to take in water. We're not going to let a person die on my watch. I'm terribly sorry. Not going to happen.
But he would have also been receiving food, and they usually put some sort of Kool-Aid or something on the food tray. I mean, like, he was deprived in a big way for a long time, and I'm baffled by this.
I'm baffled by it, and I wonder what all we don't know, because it's almost as if it was an order from administration.
Right.
Because of
and then a cover up to go along with it, to constantly put people down in that area that were like, whatever, compliant with, you know, being assholes.
Yeah.
Something along here are the known people that I know will keep a secret. I'm just, it's amazing.
Yeah, I won't, I won't name a company I worked for, but we had a situation where we had some cracked fireboxes, which will release carbon monoxide. And I'm said, I'm sorry, it's not going to happen. We're not going to pretend like we don't know about that. We're going to replace them. And if we're not, we're going to close down the units. That's just the way it's going to be under my watch. And if you don't like that, yep, you can let me go. but we're not going to have people in unsafe situations.
The one other thing in this, if I didn't do any back research, but just the picture of the sheriff of this county, I'm pretty sure that I have seen him, like during the last presidential cycle, that he was on there. He had like the big Smokey the Bear kind of hat, and he was all tough on crime and more law enforcement. If I'm not mistaken, I could totally be, I'm just kind of going from some memory, but this is not really a very upstanding individual, and he has stepped down. He's resigned based on this incident.
As he should, and hopefully he gets prosecuted.
Yeah, no doubt.
If there's any malice, if this was not an accident, hopefully he gets prosecuted if there's any deliberance of this.
Oh God, this is just atrocious, dude. I can't, you know, we pass around articles of people spitting on police and stuff like that. I still can't imagine any crime that someone could commit that's what we do to them. I bet you this would pass the muster of being cruel and unusual punishment.
I'm not sure it would.
Oh, really? Really? Well, come on, seriously?
Well, it's a pretty high standard, but this probably would.
I gotta think so. And then if you want to have, like, you know, 7 years of reading material from the appeal, there is they have a podcast. So if you don't want to read this article, you can actually listen to it. A criminal justice reform hits roadblock in Arizona. That doesn't surprise me on its own, Larry. Arizona is a tough state to try and do anything positive in reforming anything. What did you think of the article? They did at least leave a transcript.
They did, and honestly, I didn't read it all, but I'm not surprised either because of the very harsh attitudes they have in Arizona. It almost resembles the South, the Deep South, in terms of their penalty structure, and the Joe Arpaio mentality. So, for those who don't remember, that was the sheriff of Maricopa County, the pink right. underwear and the
pink
the,
underwear, the hot showers in the summer in the tents.
So,
what an asshole.
That's you know, the modest reform to let people petition off the registry died, and I'm not surprised about this. And I just say, when you go to the polls in 2020, just remember, if you're for reform, watch who's leading the charge against this, and remember their names. That's all I can tell you.
All right. And then for the second to last thing that we're going to cover tonight, and this is from law.com and the Legal Intelligencer. Pennsylvania Attorney General appeals decision to vacate ex-Penn State President Spanier conviction in child abuse scandal. Larry, I didn't read this article at all. This must have ended up in there late. Please tell me what's going on.
Well,
here.
We talked about it last week or a couple weeks back. The habeas court set aside the conviction because the law that wasn't in effect at the time he did the act. You know, it's kind of an ex post facto.
Okay.
One of those minor things called the ex post facto clause. And
overrated. Yeah.
These people, they never want to take responsibility for what they do. They always want to rely on a technicality to get out. And Spanier wants to get that pesky ex post facto clause. And this is the only reason I put this in here was because when I tell people that the state is usually going to appeal any relief, habeas corpus is an extraordinary proceeding. It's very difficult to thread the needle in federal habeas court. He threaded the needle, got through it, and got relief, and they're going to fight this, which is what they do. That was the only point I really wanted to stress, is that when you get habeas corpus relief, it's quite likely, very likely, almost 100% certain that they're going to appeal, and that's what they're doing here.
Gotcha. And that is also a person of means to really abuse, not abuse, I shouldn't say abuse, to stand up and have some sort of challenge back. I mean, he doesn't just lay down. He's got millions of dollars to push back. You have a letter from someone in civil lockup in California that we can discuss?
I'd like to read it and discuss it briefly. I'm going to try to read it verbatim. He says, "Greetings. I'm typing this note from Coalinga State prison hospital. He didn't say prison, Coalinga State Hospital in Fresno County. I'm requesting that you let me speak about my case. And this is to Narsil. On the sign, it says that you don't take SVP cases. And that means sexually violent predator. That isn't fair. We all have problems and it takes one to know one. You can't discriminate against us like that.
Takes one to know one, huh?
I'm also aware that it isn't entirely your fault. The people who you send out to handle your issues are just robots. I'm the only one who is actually human around here. Everyone else is just humanoid. I dreamed up this pathway a long time ago. I have run into myself on many occasions. The workers here are helpful, but the evil forces tend to take control of the goodness very often. I'm not here to get people into trouble. I only want to make life a better place. Since the typewriter is loud, I'll have to stop typing soon. People are watching TV, and the quiet room is occupied by another typer. Thanks for hearing me. God bless. Well, I want to clarify that we're all in advocacy disturbed about the civil commitment process as it applies to sexual offenders. No one says that we should ignore it. So I don't know who he's talking about, the robots. It certainly isn't me. We've expressed deep concern about it. The problems we face regarding civil commitment is that civil commitment is not unconstitutional.
Right.
Every state, as far as I know, has a civil commitment process. There's a different process in about 20 states for sexual offender civil commitment, which is a bogus process in terms of the due process protections and the burden of proof. It's hocus pocus. And that's the problem. But all the challenges that have been brought have failed, including one that had gained traction in Minnesota, challenging their civil commitment, where no one had ever been released. And the district court, the federal district court, found that it was unconstitutional. And of course, Minnesota appealed, and the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals overturned the panel and said, this, just because no one's gotten out doesn't mean that people can't get out. There's a process where people can get out. So therefore it is theoretically possible. You're not entitled to get out. You have a process which you can show that you're eligible to be released, but you have no right to be released. Anyway, we don't have the resources to tackle this. So if those people out there who are so alarmed about this, we would be happy at the Narsil level. I think I can speak comfortably for the board on this because I know how they think, the remaining members. We would be happy to see more done in this area. The only problem is, since we all do this on a voluntary basis and none of us get paid, we get to pick and choose what our priorities are. And although I think civil commitment that as it applies to sexual offenders is atrocious, I've got a whole lot of other things that I would prioritize my limited time to do. But I welcome people to step forward who want to fight this issue.
Which ultimately comes down to, I mean, really, the bottom line is money and or help from people that can do heavy lifting.
Well, that's right. And it also comes down to the fact that it's a losing proposition. You're going to attract a lot less, after the Eighth Circuit flipped the district judge, you're going to attract a lot less interest because the attorneys are going to look at all the case law, the body of case law that's significant in this, and it all runs against finding sexual offender civil commitment to be unconstitutional. Now, it could be that a particular program is so egregiously flawed that you would find that program needs to be improved, but they still wouldn't find that you couldn't do civil commitment. It would be like, for example, if they were to find that there was no reasonable process for a person to have a review. They would say this is unconstitutional because the person never gets the opportunity to be reviewed. Well, all you'd have to do would be to provide a review process, and that would cure that unconstitutionality. That would make it so that they couldn't have civil commitment anymore. It would make it so they'd have to have a more robust process for people who were in civil commitment. You could possibly argue that people are not getting proper treatment, and you could force the states that are doing so-called civil commitment to actually provide treatment rather than just warehousing.
that would not mean that you couldn't commit them. It would just mean that you would have to actually provide treatment during the time that they're committed. So there's no silver bullet that's going to end civil commitment unless there's a legislative enactment to abolish it. The courts can't end civil commitment because it is constitutionally to civilly commit people. As far as I know, all states do it.
Well, I don't have anything else to say about that. Are we ready to either hit the Scalia clip or cover this this memorandum opinion and order?
I think we need to do our new segment with Justice Scalia. We're gonna try to make this a regular.
This will be This Week in Opining by Samuel. What's his name? Justice Scalia. What's his first name?
Antonin.
Right. All right. So here is what I mocked up today.
In your new book, you explain your approach to judging, which is called textualism or originalism. What exactly is that?
Originalism is sort of a subspecies of textualism. Textualism means you're governed by the text. That's the only thing that is relevant to your decision. Not whether the outcome is desirable, not whether legislative history says this or that, but the text of the statute. Originalism says that when you consult the text, you give it the meaning it had when it was adopted, not some later modern meaning.
So if it was the Constitution written in the 18th century, you try to find what those words meant in the 18th
exactly,
century.
Exactly. The best example being the death penalty. I've sat with three colleagues who thought it was unconstitutional, but it's absolutely clear that the American people never voted to proscribe the death penalty. They adopted a cruel and unusual punishments clause at the time when every state had the death penalty and every state continued to have it. Nobody thought that the Eighth Amendment prohibited it.
All right. You criticize, and this gets to, as you say, some of your colleagues, another approach, using a word I have to admit that I did not know existed prior to reading your book, purposivism. Did I pronounce that correctly?
Yeah, you did. It's a nice long word.
All right.
I didn't make it up.
What does it mean?
What it means is, and it's probably the most popular form of interpretation in recent times. It means consulting the purpose of the statute and deciding the case on the basis of what will further the purpose. Now, textualists consult purpose as well, but only the purpose that is apparent in the very text.
And that was our weekly segment on Antonin Scalia.
You're going to hear more of the late Justice Scalia. The point of that was that a lot of what you hear me say, since I have followed the man, I've followed him through his career from the time President Reagan appointed him until the time he passed away. And I've had great admiration for the man's intellectual ability. And he shied away from no debates, and he made it clear where he stood. But when I tell people that, like in these recent rulings that we've talked about, where they did not go to purposivism, they did it by textualism, that if you believe you're for textualism, then you would be delighted at the recent rulings we discussed because they simply went by the text. They did not try to figure out what a greater public policy good would be done if we went by purposivism. And so sometimes people think they're for something that they're not. And as we go through Scalia, I'll still be an admirer of him because he's such an intellectually brilliant guy. But you'll find that you disagree with almost everything that he did on the bench. But you still like the guy. So that's what we're going to do is help people understand. If you had the court filled with Scalia, you just might not be very happy with how everything comes down because he believes there's great deference to what the people decide. And if the people don't like something, they need to change it. And if the purpose is not clear in the text, it's not for him to decide what a greater purpose would be. That's for people to go back and correct through the legislative process. Don't tell me your problems. You wrote a bad statute. It's not clear. if you can't write, then that's not my problem. But as far as I can see, if it says this, that's what it means. That's what the words mean. And that's what we're going to do. And that's a textualist. And that's where he came down on his judging.
Do you think it is okay? How do I word this appropriately? There are times when, and I'm sure you do this too, there are times when you think that having some, you know, old time view is good, and sometimes you want something that is a new time view. And obviously people are going to differ there. And our Supreme Court justices will do the same thing. They'll try to legislate from the bench where they think it is appropriate, and then the other side will bitch that they're doing it. Is that okay, or should we maintain intellectual integrity and honesty and consistency across all subjects all the time?
I don't think it's humanly possible to do that. Legislating from the bench is a dangerous thing. I mean, even if you think you're for it, it's dangerous, because then you remove the people's representatives from the process. If the courts become super legislators and their power goes unchecked, then the careful balancing of powers goes away. So the court's proper role is not to legislate from the bench, and that's a dangerous thing. And you'll hear Justice Scalia say that what judges can give it, they can also take it away. If the courts can create a right, what precludes them from taking away a right?
Yep.
I think I've got a quote of him coming up in the next week or two of him saying the Constitution is dead. He doesn't buy into that evolving standard of decency that's a living document. He says it's a dead document. So, but he's a fascinating man. I mean, people should enjoy hearing from him, even if you don't agree with him. I certainly enjoy hearing. Every time he was on an interview, I tried my best to hear it.
And you probably have hours and hours of VHS tapes of him, right?
I don't have hours, but I have gone on YouTube and began to assemble quite a few for future reviews. So I think we'll be well stocked on Scalia for a while.
Let's try and knock this out fairly quickly. We are running very, very long. What do we have on this United States versus Guy Rosenshine? I have no idea what this is. And you said it's even a struggle for you.
It's a struggle for me, but it's good because it's a win for the defense. And it's a federal prosecution in the District Court of New Mexico regarding the assistance. And we're going to highlight the 23-page opinion, and the legal beagles can read it. But the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children has become an arm of the prosecution. And this is, to simplify it, this is a defendant asking for discovery from NCMEC, and a district judge agreeing that he's entitled to certain of the stuff he's asked for, denied him on other things that he's asked for. But this is there's very little case law. The judge's law clerk couldn't find a lot of case law to guide in terms of making this decision on whether NCMEC is a partner and a tool of the prosecution. So it potentially is significant. If it doesn't get appealed, it'll become the practice in this district, which is one state. The whole state is one federal district because of the low population. But if they appeal it and the Tenth Circuit upholds it, then it would become the rule of the entire circuit. So potentially this is some good stuff that we can talk about going forward on how this unravels. But I don't know how you could consider them to be anything other than on the prosecution team if they provide the tips that generates the warrant, the search of the person's. If you get searched because of a NCMEC tip and they turn over to local law enforcement, what they did and how they went about determining that you were a suspect and what they turned over, I don't see how that would be anything other than making you a tool of the prosecution.
Are they a private entity, though?
No, they're government, as I understand it.
Okay. It feels like it'd be somewhat of a conflict of interest if they were collecting that data and passing it along. But if they're a government agency, then I guess, you know, it's just them passing information amongst themselves.
I highlight it. Says this matter comes before the court on motion to compel production of NCMEC materials. Defendant Guy Rosenshine seeks to compel the government to produce certain information and possession of the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children in accordance with Rule 16 and Brady versus Maryland, which is a United States Supreme Court decision from back in the liberal heyday of 63 about what discovery must be provided. And it says the questions at the heart of the motion are whether NCMEC is part of the prosecution team for purposes of discovery and whether the information defendant seeks to compel is material to his defense, because that's a part of the test under Brady. You don't have the right to everything that they've ever done in the course of an investigation. You have the right to what's material to your, and you have to be a little bit more precise. You just can't say, give me all you got, which is what one of their motions, right. A couple of their motions did here, said, give us everything. But the judge narrowed down and issued an order saying that they're entitled to a lot of stuff here. And I don't even understand the order because it's so, there were so many motions filed. And then, you get list A and you get list G and you, I couldn't even follow it all, but the significance is it's a win for the defense. And so the legal beagles should read this, but it says the Brady rule, which is the case, the Supreme Court case, is not an evidentiary rule that grants, it's not an evidentiary rule that grants broad discovery powers to a defendant because there is no general constitutional right to discovery in a criminal case. So that was unique. I didn't even realize that, but I've read it once. I plan to read it again, but we won something. Yeah.
Because there is no general constitutional right to discovery.
That's
the defendant doesn't have a right to the information that is being used to prosecute them of something.
That's what it says. The Brady rule is not an evidentiary rule that grants broad discovery powers to a defendant because there is no general constitutional right to discovery. I'm just reading verbatim from here.
I found it in the text. I was like, that doesn't sound like that would put you on an even playing field to even be able to defend yourself.
So, but then we have Rule 16 under Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure, and it goes into a long, laborious explanation of that. But for Brady purposes, this is on page 9, the prosecution includes not only the individual prosecutor handling the case, but also the prosecutor's entire office, as well as the law enforcement personnel and other arms of the state involved in investigative aspects of a particular criminal venture. And then they cite the 10th Circuit Smith versus Secretary of New Mexico Department of Corrections. Well, it certainly sounds like Dick Mick had an investigative aspect of this case from what I'm reading here.
Interesting.
So our legal gurus can have fun with this.
And feel free to send in any follow-up questions that you would like to ask, because my head is spinning beyond anything that I could comprehend.
So
thank you for bringing that to us, Larry.
Well, it's the prosecution wins so often that on the defense listservs, when we win a favorable motion to suppress or do anything, this just lights up the listserv because the courts always rule against us. So this one lit up the listserv yesterday, so I couldn't help myself.
Are we done?
We're getting close.
Okay. What else is there? That's the end of the roster.
That is. So we can tell people. How would people make this podcast expand and explode?
Do you remember the shampoo commercial back in the day where if they tell two friends, then they'll tell two friends and so on and so on. And then your screen ends up with like 800 women telling that they're going to share, shampoo their hair with whatever it was. That's how we're going to grow. Share it with two people.
I remember that, but the difference is the two people of your next two friends, do they have any interest in the matters we discuss on this podcast?
I honestly think that we have a little bit broader of a reach than possibly we think, because we are talking about how to change laws that impact you. So it's not necessarily specifically related to this, but that would just be my take, because we do cover like, hey, you have to get in there and talk to these people to get them to change the way that they think. If we don't do it, then they just accept the default of whatever they get.
We ought to consider renaming it something other than Registry Matters.
No, that's not happening. We'll just start a whole new podcast for that.
Uh-huh. All righty. I can tell you're open-minded, all right?
Yes, I'm very open-minded. But go to the website, registrymatters.co. And from there, I would encourage anyone that is listening to us that doesn't have a subscription, then feel free to sign up for email alerts. We have there's a way that when a new episode comes out, it'll shoot you an email message. Don't forget that we have a YouTube channel that I would love for you to sign up at. It helps, you know, having numbers. And then also, if you want to follow us on Twitter, there are a bunch of other accounts that I could share with you to, but search for us as Registry Matters on Twitter.
Or you can call us at our famous number, 747-227-4477, and we would love to have your question. It's compact and concise as you can possibly make it.
The guys tonight did an awesome job with that too.
And thank you for the questions.
And registrymatterscast@gmail.com. And what is the best way to support the podcast, Larry?
Best way would be to go to your local bank and close your account.
Close it.
And tell the banker to direct everything that's in the account to Register Matters.
Wow, you went that way. So, hey, I'm going to close out my account and make the final check out to the Registry Matters podcast.
And I doubt anybody's going to do that. But if you would like to, if you would like to support us in any way, and there's so many people that are supporting us beyond what I would ever imagine that they would do, and I'm just I don't know. There's not words to describe how I feel that we're able to bring a value to folks that they feel that generous. But you can go to Patreon, as what's his name says, or is it Patreon?
I'm not saying who says it. It's Patreon. I'm not saying who says it.
So patreon.com/registrymatters. And
absolutely, thank you so much to the patrons. It is absolutely amazing that you guys help us out.
And you can sign up for as little as $1 a month. And then the sky's the limit. I don't think they have a limit on the upper side. The dollar's the least, but I don't think they have a limit that I've seen on the other side.
Probably not. You would run out of money before you ran into the limit. That would be my guess.
So,
and you're going to get this before the conference. So if you are listening to this and you happen to get to the conference, please, please, please come over, say hi. There will probably be a live recording somewhere. So maybe we'll have some sort of impromptu and some live audience participation and whatnot. That would be pretty stellar, but I don't know what the schedule is, and maybe we can work out something like that when we're there in Houston. Larry.
We could do that. We're going to have ample rooms. We're going to have the Deer Park room upstairs. Yeah. We're going to have the Port Lavaca room next to the main event. So we'll have room space. So we could, depending on how many people wanted to watch, we could possibly record live and have audience participation. We could announce that from the we could add that to the announcements once we get there. So look forward to doing that. I think we could do a nice podcast at the conference.
Yes, I agree. Larry, I hope you have a great night, and I will see you in a handful of days.
Thanks a lot. Good night, everybody.
Bye.
You're listening to FYP.